Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. Coming up on today's programs, Solomon Islands begins grim task of recovery on Santa Cruz. Australia ready to send disaster aid to Solomon Islands after they were struck by a tsunami because of a major earthquake that hit off the coast of Solomon Islands. Naval near miss inflames Sino-Japanese tensions, and China puts a ban on luxury goods advertising. We have this and much more on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. The grim task of going through the wreckage on the coastal areas of Santa Cruz and the Solomon Islands has begun after Wednesday's earthquake generated a tsunami. Waves up to a meter hit the coastal villages, and at least 8 people have been killed. Exact figures are hard to confirm at this stage because of the remote location. Tracy Hutchinson speaks next to Sipor Rove, the Programs and Media Officer of the Natural Disaster Management Office in Honiara.
We have 4 missing, the reports coming in are still sketchy, but around 5-6 injuries.
Yes. Now, just in terms of the difficulty of actually getting to the location itself, is that part of the problem, that you're not sure how many people were actually living there and just how extensive the damage is?
That's correct. Yeah. Most of the reports that we are having are from Lata Station, which is the surrounding villages around Lata Station. Lata is a government station, the capital of Temotu Province. From here in Honiara, it's quite far. Mm. It takes around 3 hours by plane to reach Temotu Province.
So in terms of how authorities and support people, the disaster relief people, are getting to help the people affected, how are you doing that?
The patrol boat is leaving around this time for Lata in the Temotu Province, but then it will take a little bit more time before it reaches Temotu.
What have you been told about how extensive the damage has been in terms of the number of houses and destruction that it's caused, how many people might have been left homeless? Do you have any idea at all at this stage?
At this stage, we are looking at around 430 households either damaged or destroyed, which leaves around 3,000 people affected. We were not really sure as to how many were homeless at the moment, yeah.
Yes, and you mentioned that a patrol boat was leaving. What sort of relief, what sort of assistance are you hoping that it can actually get through to them?
We have loaded the patrol boat with clean drinking water, rice, water containers, tarpaulins, and other shelter kits that we think will be necessary for the affected community.
When do you expect you might be able to finalise some of those figures about the number of people that have been killed and injured?
We have the Emergency Operations Centre in Lata, which are not working very well. Those people were also affected, so they are not really picking up and giving us the information. Possibly the first team will be in Santa Cruz at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. The best assessment team will be there by then, but a team of doctors maybe will be flown earlier, maybe in the morning.
The Australian government is poised to provide supplies and reconstruction help to the earthquake-ravaged Solomon Islands. Foreign Affairs Minister Bob Carr has expressed condolences to the government and people of Solomon Islands. Richard Marles is the Parliamentary Secretary for Pacific Island Affairs and the Parliamentary Secretary for Foreign Affairs. Bruce Hill asked him if Solomon Islands has already made a formal request for disaster aid.
Yeah, Bruce, we got that request during the afternoon, so that now is in place, and I've been in contact with the Prime Minister of the Solomon Islands this afternoon, and we will be talking with them in more detail as over the coming days about exactly what support we provide. But right now there is a RAF Hercules, which is in the air, which we've dispatched, which will be doing a flyover of of the affected islands today, and we'll be looking at how we can deploy that better tomorrow. One of the issues today has been that the airstrip at Lata has not been operable until the last few hours because the tsunami actually went over the airstrip, which meant that it was unable to land aircraft this morning. But I understand that it's in a better state now and small planes will be able to go in there, and we hope that larger ones will in the days to come. The other point to make is that one of the patrol boats, which the Solomon Islands has, which have been supplied by, which has been supplied by the Australian government, but they're run by the Solomon Islands, and is getting ready to head down to the islands. That's about a 30-hour sailing time, so it'll take a day or two to get down there and be able to provide a sense of what's going on and start the process of reconstruction.
Once we've done this flyover and we've actually got some people on the ground, and the Solomon Islands government's got some people on the ground with the assessments, do we know what kind of support they're going to be needing? Are we talking about food, medicine, that sort of thing?
I think that they are the kind of things, and I think in time there'll also be a reconstruction effort which is going to be required. There is certainly going to be some damage to housing, but the extent of that we're unable to determine at the moment. But they are exactly the kinds of things that will be needed. I think one of the things we really need to understand is the extent of injury. Obviously, in terms of loss of life, at this point the number that is being reported by the Solomon Islands government is 7. But we're talking about a really remote part of the world, Bruce. This is the better part of 700 nautical miles from Honiara itself. Normally, it's serviced irregularly by twin otter aircraft, and it's actually closer to Vanuatu than it is to Honiara. And there are going to be remote villages there that it's going to take some time to get to. And until we get to them, we're actually not going to know what the full extent of injury and loss of life is.
It's a particularly challenging part of the world. It's just very, very remote, even from the main part of Solomon Islands. It's quite a long way from anywhere. So once the airstrip at Lata is cleared off, is that going to be able to take any of the larger planes, or does it only take smaller aircraft?
No, I think it will be able to take larger planes once it is cleared off. As my understanding is, as of this minute, it can take a Dash 8, but which is a smaller aircraft, but it needs to be in a state where it can actually take some larger aircraft so that we can be looking at landing people and supplies in there. But these are all issues which are being worked through by the Solomon Islands Disaster Management Council. I know it met last night. The Solomon Islands Cabinet's actually meeting as we speak in relation to these issues, and we're obviously working very closely with the Solomon Islands government to work out what assistance we can provide as this unfolds. But we're certainly, today we stand shoulder to shoulder with the people of the Solomon Islands because this is a very difficult moment.
When you spoke with the Solomon Islands Prime Minister earlier today, what did he have to tell you about what they need and what they'd like from Australia?
It was short. I was in contact with him. He's actually been in a cabinet meeting, and so we were actually swapping texts during that. But I think he appreciated the fact that we were offering support, and it means a lot. And their desire is to make sure that we're able to be there for whatever is needed, and that's going to be worked out over the days to come.
That was Richard Miles, the Parliamentary Secretary for the Pacific Island Affairs, speaking with Bruce Hill. Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has condemned China following revelations that a Chinese frigate locked its weapons-firing radar on a Japanese destroyer near a group of disputed islands in the East China Sea. Mr. Abe called it a dangerous unilateral provocative act and appealed to Beijing to exercise restraint. This is the latest incident between the two sides, and it's a very worrying sign for stability in the region. Mark Willacy has more.
They're windswept specks poking out of the East China Sea. Their only residents are a few hardy goats, the descendants of a few castaways left by some Japanese nationalists in the 1970s. But to China, they're the Diaoyu Islands, sovereign territory of the People's Republic. Beijing claiming the islands appear in Chinese literature dating back 8 centuries. To Japan, which controls them, they're the Senkakus, islands used by 19th century Japanese to harvest albatross feathers and for processing and drying fish, a territory taken from Japan after World War II and then returned at the end of the US occupation of Okinawa in 1972. In the 1970s, the leaders of China and Japan agreed to let the issue of sovereignty slide for a later, wiser generation to work out. This generation of political leaders appears to be letting these volcanic specks push Asia's two giants towards possible conflict. A Chinese military-class frigate used a fire control radar against a Japanese escort ship, says Japan's defence minister Itsunori Onodera. The defence ministry has been looking to confirm the type of radar used, and we've now confirmed that this was indeed a fire control radar of the type used to help guide weapons, the minister says. The incident near the disputed islands took place last week, and Tokyo says it wasn't just a Japanese destroyer that was targeted by the Chinese fire control radar. It says a Chinese frigate had earlier locked its radar on one of Japan's ship-based helicopters. And according to Japan, the only thing the Chinese Navy captain had to do then to fire a missile was to hit a button. Having this sort of fire control system used is indeed very unusual, says Japan's defence minister Itsunori Onodera. If someone took a wrong step, it could have become a very dangerous situation. As such, we have indeed lodged our protests through diplomatic channels, he says. Another thing this incident reveals is that both sides have some serious naval hardware floating around these disputed islands, a fact China and Japan have been very secretive about. And this isn't the first time the two militaries have come into recent contact over these outcrops. Last month, Chinese and Japanese warplanes shadowed each other near the islands. Jeff Kingston from Japan's Temple University says the dispute has the potential to flare into a conflict at any moment.
Nobody thinks it makes any sense at all to fight a war over these islands. Certainly there are a lot of signs that would suggest that may happen. And once there's blood in the water, that's going to make it very, very difficult to find a compromise. It's already difficult enough right now.
Few believe Japan and China want to go to war over a few specks in the East China Sea. But these specks are believed to be surrounded by vast fields of oil and gas. Throw in strident nationalism and a troubled, often violent history between China and Japan, and it's clear this dispute has the potential to threaten the peace and prosperity of the North Asian region.
China has moved to ban advertising of a range of luxury items on state radio and television. China has moved to ban advertising of luxury items, including watches, rare stamps, and gold coins, on all major TV and radio stations in the country. In addition, from April, billboards in Beijing promoting luxury lifestyles will have to be removed, and words like luxury, royal, supreme, and high class will also have to be deleted. The new restrictions follow a ban introduced last October on civil servants splurging on boozy banquets and fancy cars. For more, we have this report from Kandahar Sepati.
With China's economy booming and its middle class and millionaires growing in leaps and bounds, it has become the haven for luxury goods seeking a growing market. From luxury cars to exclusive watches, high-end liquor, and top-end designer goods, they can all be found in China's major cities. But given the widening income gap, China fears advertisements of luxury items could create social discontent. Rajiv Biswas is the Asia-Pacific chief economist for consulting agency IHS Global.
They're particularly worried about the risk of social unrest if the gulf in living standards becomes too great. And particularly if you see very conspicuous consumption on extravagant luxury goods and very top-range cars.
China has a tradition of gift-giving, and in recent times it has become common for politicians and government officials to bestow lavish gifts for political and personal gain. Mr. Biswas says for the ordinary Chinese, this practice thinks of corruption and an arguable abuse of public money.
Many of the big companies in China are still state-owned. So even if it's not the actual government departments, where I think there's probably strict control still on such gift-giving, I think the bigger concern would be the large state-owned companies, including large banks or other large government enterprises, where they are doing these corporate practices of giving gifts, and the scale of such gift giving has just become too extravagant in the context of the social disparities and also fears about increasing corruption as well.
The government fears unless corruption is weeded out, the survival of the Communist Party could be in jeopardy. Chen Xindong, an analyst with BT Paribas Peregrine Securities in Beijing, says the government has now brought in a ruling that would make it illegal for lavish goods to be given as gifts.
The Chinese Communist Party Discipline Inspection Department made one point clear that it's not only those official who takes bribery will be punished, but for those businessmen who give the bribery to official, exceeding 10,000 renminbi is subjectable to the criminal charge.
So will these curbs on spending and advertisements of luxury goods have an impact on the suppliers of these items? Not in the long term, says Mr. Chen.
I think for the time being and for a certain period of time, it should be quite significant compared to the previous years. However, it does not mean, well, on the one hand, the government will try to restrict consumptions on luxury goods. It's not for ordinary rich Chinese. They actually does not have any limitation for that. So therefore, the luxury goods sales in the future will be targeting to the normal consumption rather than to be used as a tool for corruptions or bribery.
It's a view that Mr. Biswas shares.
The Chinese economic growth story is so phenomenal that there'll still be plenty of private sector gift-giving continuing, and that will continue to support relatively strong growth in China as the world's probably fastest-growing luxury market for many years to come.
China's bans are not going to stop producers of luxury goods from tapping into this rich market. In fact, wealthy Chinese are now going abroad on spending sprees. And it's not unusual for producers of branded goods to unveil limited editions of an item to lure them. Last year, Rolls-Royce Year of the Dragon Phantom car, priced at more than $1.3 million, were all sold out within 8 weeks. Mr. Chen says the government is not against luxury goods. Rather, its recent bans are aimed at curbing corruption.
High-end luxury goods, the control or the government tried to water down this consumption is because there is a lot of corruption related. But that's not mean China want to kill consumption appetite for the high-end consumer goods.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. If you wish to contact us, our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. Officials in Indonesia have uncovered an attempt to smuggle more than a ton of Australian beef into the country. They say the shipment was sent from Singapore and falsely labeled as fish. Authorities say the detection shows the length that some are prepared to go to get beef into Indonesia's tightly controlled market. For more, we have this report from Helen Brown in Jakarta.
It was labelled as a container of fish, but when quarantine officials looked inside, they found something else. Among small cakes and smoked salmon was 1.4 tons of prime Australian beef. Officials impounded the container on Saturday. They say it originated in Singapore and was most likely packed there. Meat imports have become a highly political issue. The nation's anti-corruption unit has detained the former chief of a major political party, suspecting him of receiving bribes as part of the meat import system. And officers in the agricultural ministry have been searched. Beef prices have been soaring as supply has diminished under stricter government quotas, limits that are imposed to help local farmers.
demand is always high, and I know that we have also the domestic
consumption,
domestic supply that we have to balance.
The paperwork for the container raised some red flags with officials, and they brought it here for inspection, where their suspicions were confirmed.
Indonesian officials say they'll be alerting their Australian counterparts about the beef that's ended up somewhere else.
Later on, we're going to have kind of notification of non-compliance since the country of origin from Australia, of course, yes. We're going to notify the Australia.
The 117 boxes of meat are now in the hands of quarantine.
And finally on the program, in recent weeks, writers, academics, actors and artists have come under attack from India's political class and fringe parties for criticizing the established order. Intellectuals feel intolerance is growing in India and freedoms are being curtailed. We have this story from Murali Krishna.
It has become increasingly easy these days to offend the Indian government and incur the wrath of the censor or even the threat of legal action. Actor Kamala Hassan learnt it the hard way and was forced to reach a settlement with Muslim organizations in southern India, agreeing finally to delete 7 scenes from his latest spy thriller. Earlier, the actor had threatened to leave his state and was pained by the response of the authorities to his mega-production Vishwarupam, or the gigantic guardian figure, that revolves around an Indian intelligence agent thwarting a terrorist attack by fighters from Afghanistan in New York.
I think I'll have to seek a secular state for me to stay in. I've lost what I've got. When I have nothing to lose, I might as well choose. And that choice would be a place where it will be a secular state, from Kashmir to Kerala, excluding Tamil Nadu.
Artistic expression is being increasingly given a political and even a communal color. And over the weeks, this has set off protests on the streets, court battles, and loud debates on artistic freedom across the country. Ritu Menon, a publisher and writer who's been active in the South Asian women's movement for over 20 years, explains this disturbing phenomenon.
It is actually an indication of two things. One, the prevalence of what we call street censorship or laissez-faire censorship, which is to say no one can be held responsible. The street, as you know, the mob forms and dissolves, so no one can be criminalized for it. That's one. The second is, it's happening much more often because, as we know, the more regressive the state, the more aggressive the mob. The state is simply withdrawing from the public sphere.
At the just-concluded Jaipur Literature Festival, hundreds of people stage a protest demonstration outside the venue, demanding the immediate arrest of eminent sociologist Ashish Nandi for his reported remarks against members of the backward classes, scheduled castes and tribes. Though Nandi said he was misunderstood, the clamour for his arrest grew. Makaran Paranjape is a poet, an English professor at Jawaharlal Nehru University.
It seems to me that the state, which is the guarantor of the rights which are enshrined in the constitution, is extremely amenable to pressure groups, all kinds of minority and fringe elements who have nuisance value. And because the state essentially is run by people, I mean, they're worried about maintaining their power, they kowtow to these interests.
The unpleasant events over the last few weeks also saw writer Salman Rushdie being denied entry into Kolkata to promote Deepa Mehta's film Midnight's Children, based on his book by the same name. He was not allowed to enter the city, and the reason cited for stopping him was that some Muslims felt the author was anti-Islam. Last year, amid death threats to the organizers and fears of violent riots by Muslim groups, Rushdie was prevented from making an appearance or even addressing the Jaipur Literature Festival through a video link. Ms. Menon again.
Civil society is now becoming much more vocal as a group, and individuals are voicing their dissent through the arts, through cinema, film, theater, books, and so on. It's becoming extremely uncomfortable for the state to address this. And in order not to address it, they are allowing a mob, which really has nobody's interests at heart, to do their dirty work for them.
Mr. Paranjape agrees.
What's actually happening is that the political class is unable to stand up and finds it easier to appease such elements. And what they're doing is they're leaving their job to other people, like the media who will raise a hullabaloo, or to the judiciary where people go when they are in trouble. So my point is that what's really happening is a failure of governance.
Social commentator Santosh Desai is a keen watcher of how India faces new threats to artistic freedom.
What we are seeing is almost as if the idealism of earlier times turned out to be a kind of a thin veneer, which has worn out. And the newer forces that are coming into power are actually seeing power in more transactional terms as a force to be exercised, and therefore have much fewer compunctions about using that power to restrict basic freedoms.
The big question is whether India will be able to find the right balance that leans more towards freedom and less towards repression. Murali Krishnan, New Delhi.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. Once again, if you wish to contact us, our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. If you want to listen to this program again or past editions, you can visit the website, which is www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. Once again, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. Now, many of you are hearing this program on Chinese New Year's Eve, the 9th of February, or in some places, the 8th of February. Now, Chinese New Year's Eve and Chinese New Year, of course, is a really, really big year. This, of course, is the year of the snake. So I thought that today we'd end with a song about Chinese New Year. It's a song that came out many, many years ago from a legendary Taiwan singer by the name of Teresa Tang. Those of you who are Chinese speakers will know her as Dali Jun. Well, way back, many years ago, she recorded a song called Good New Year. So that's how we end today's program. So on behalf of everyone here, I'd like to say, first in Mandarin, Gong Xi Fa Chai, and for our Cantonese speakers, Gong Hei Fa Choi. Teresa Tang, Good New Year. We'll see you in 7 days' time. Bye-bye, everyone.
转眼又是新年到，新年到，丰收的新年多热闹，大街小巷放鞭炮，舞龙灯，踩高跷，迎财神，接元宝，家家户户乐逍遥，家家户户乐逍遥。四季里收成好，转眼又是新年到。 丰收的新年过热闹，大街呀和尚香放鞭炮，舞龙灯踩高跷，迎财神，接元宝，家家户户乐逍遥。过新年人人笑，见面说声新年好，新年好，快乐的新年多热闹。 无论男女和老少，穿新衣，戴新帽，大家乐，乐淘淘，大家欢迎新年到，大家欢迎新年到。过新年人人笑，见面要说声新年好，新年好。 Yeah.